Good morning. You're listening to Thin Air Community Radio. You're also listening to Praxis. I'm live in the studio with Kyle Chamberlain, who has been on the show before quite a while ago, and I condensed our hour and a half long interview into about 20 minutes. So back to do full justice to the topics we want to talk about live instead. So we're going to talk about his human habitat project and various other things that come to mind, the disasters of agriculture that we witnessed last night, partially. I don't know if people saw, but I heard the wind and went outside to look at the storm, and I couldn't figure out what the weird fog was. And then I realized that it was dirt and dust, which I've never seen a dust storm get that deep into the city and that crazy. So that's what's going on.
Yeah, I was licking my teeth and thinking, it tastes like Adams County. I used to live in Moses Lake, and I've driven around and photographed dust storms like that. And one really different perspective you can get on those dust storms is NASA has released satellite imagery of different natural disasters, and Columbia Basin dust storms are one of them. And if you can track it down online, you can see the image of a dust storm in the Columbia Basin from space, and it spans an area nearly from the Tri-Cities to Cheney. It's this big brown streak. Pretty impressive. And also doubly impressive considering that they happen as a result of human activities and the things that we do to the land.
Yeah, so what... So I was thinking about the Dust Bowl, too, because coincidentally, yesterday, I was tearing up a magazine to feed to my worms, my worm compost that's going to single-handedly save the world, obviously. And there was a review of the Ken Burns Dust Bowl documentary. And I just think it's interesting that, you know, this isn't a new weird thing. It's not a new type of storm that we're going to be seeing because of climate change. It's happened repeatedly over time. So maybe that's a good segue into how did you start thinking about humans having a habitat and doing the work that you're doing? And what does that have to do with Adams County dust teeth?
Yeah, well, I have lived in really agricultural places in Eastern Washington and really urban places, and having licked the dust of my teeth off my teeth, I've wondered why all this trouble? Why work so hard? Why influence so much land? Don't human beings have a habitat like any other creature might, like a squirrel or a deer, you know, where the things that they need are provided by the environment, and they don't have to, you know, as the Bible says, labor by the sweat of their brow, as we do out in the Columbia Basin. And I've been thinking about this for a long time, and doing my homework, and naturally where I was led in thinking about human habitat was East Africa, you know, the origins of human beings. And I think a lot of us, when we imagine kind of the paradise or Garden of Eden or our human habitat, we think of some place in the tropics, you know, maybe some sandy beach somewhere, and there are coconuts falling out of the trees. And I was always very interested in our region here, in the Inland Northwest, and I wanted to see if I could find connections between our tropical origins, and how our needs were met there, and how human needs were met in like colder, more temperate regions like ours, and I found out some really interesting things. You know, if you look at the origin of the Homo genus, which includes, you know, Homo erectus and Neanderthals and ourselves, that did happen in East Africa. But if you go even further back and look at the origins of primates, you're taken back to a time after the dinosaurs went extinct, where Eurasia and North America were joined into one large continent, covered by continuous forest from the Arctic to nearly the equator. And in those forests evolved the first primates. And some of their fossils can be found in North America. There's one on display at the John Day Fossil Beds in Oregon. It's this tiny tooth that you can tell is the fossil tooth belonging to a creature that I think is named in Sioux. I'll do my best to pronounce this word. It's Egomowechashala. But later there were other primates living in North America. There's one called Teal Hardina that lived 55 million years ago. It's a really cute little guy. He looks kind of like a squirrel, possum.
Lemur, maybe.
Yeah. And this later one here, Placetopus, lived 58 million years ago and also lived in North America. And it was living in a forest that you might recognize, this Arcto-Tertiary forest, this forest that spanned the northern hemisphere at the time, incorporated trees that are today separated on different continents. But the tertiary norm is that you'd find, say, Douglas firs growing with ginkgos, and you know, you had Douglas firs growing in Europe at the time. So the forest that we look at here in the Northwest is one that we've been co-evolving with. It's one that has been meeting our needs since we climbed in the canopy of it. And this kind of research, I begin to think, well, do we really need to hearken back to Africa to find our habitat when we've been here for a long time? Another interesting fact I discovered was that an early kind of proto-human, Homo erectus, occupied northeast China 1.7 million years ago. And northeast China is actually a very similar environment to our own. Today it's where steppe meets the forest. And Homo erectus is believed to be the first hominid species to leave Africa. And so while Homo erectus may not be directly related to us, it goes to show that people have been living in cold regions for a very long time. And they think he might have been eating hackberries. They found evidence of hackberry consumption in his fire pits. And there are hackberries growing along the lower reaches of the Columbia River today. These earlier hominids, Neanderthals in particular, share some of their genes with us today. My father had his blood work done. He sent his blood into National Geographic and discovered that he has some Neanderthal DNA and also possibly some Denisovan DNA, which was another human species that lived in Eurasia for a very long time. I think humans arrived in, like, left Africa maybe 60 million years ago. But when you look at it this way, you find that the whole northern hemisphere is kind of ecologically connected, and we could very well look out the window here in the inland Northwest and think, this is home. This is where I evolved. This is my habitat.
And what... I guess, okay, so it's obviously a long story. It's a millions of years long story. But who thought it was a good idea to leave the habitat that was providing for people? Was it one guy who we can go find? I mean, that's the story of civilization, which is something I talk about here and there. But why do you think, in having studied this, what made humans turn away from that?
Sure. I was just at the Inland Northwest Permaculture Convergence at Hayden Lake and listened to a talk of Toby Hemingway's about the origins of agriculture. And agriculture really marks the first time that the people are in a very totalitarian way kind of removing an ecology and replacing it with something of their own making. The Neolithic Revolution, as it's called, the invention of agriculture, happened in the Middle East about 11,000 years ago. But it happened simultaneously in other parts of the world at about the same time. So we can't blame one guy for this. But that critical turning point at which we cease adapting to the ecologies that we live in and start replacing them with others kind of set in motion this path, this trajectory that we're on today. It led to industrialization. It led to enormous population growth. And it led to the dust storms that we witnessed here last night, which are the result, really, of taking a grassland. The land to the west of Spokane was once a perennial grassland, and turning it into annual crop, where the earth must be exposed for prolonged periods of time, and these polluted soils, these lowest soils that we're farming, blew in. That's the definition of a lost soil. And the only thing that can hold soil that blows in is perennial vegetation, whether that's forests or grass. And it was the Neolithic Revolution that was the end of perennial vegetation in a lot of places.
So here, because like you said, in the Middle East and these other nodes where this happened earlier, now, when people picture the Middle East, they picture Iraq, they don't picture cedar forests, they picture sand blowing around, they picture desert. But here we have what I guess is a benefit of agriculture not having happened for very long in the grand scheme of things. Could you talk a little bit about just the history here, as far as if we're going to talk about the Columbia Basin, that's kind of the broad area. How long ago was it that people were just living in more or less an intact ecology here?
The indigenous way of life here kind of faded out not very long ago. Faded out is the wrong word. But for instance, there were people living in Tule Mat lodges at Priest Rapids in the 1950s, we're talking about a very rapid culture change, less than 200 years. I'm looking for my history of the Palouse.
No worries. I can read this quote, actually, while you're looking. This is something that Kyle sent me a few months ago before our first interview, and it's from Mourning Dove, who's a Colville author who died in 1936. My people did not farm and had no use for crops until the salmon runs began to disappear from the streams and rivers. White activities causing pollution and commercial fishing projects were the cause of this. Every year, the Colville found fewer salmon to take, not enough to live on, and so began to farm to stay alive. Finally, dams were built on the Columbia, and the salmon were stopped altogether from coming above Grand Coulee. The salmon were gone, and high-powered rifles are doing about the same to our game animals. By the time we saw the need to farm, the younger generations realized their ancestors had let the whites have the richest and most fertile bottomland, and it was too late to get it back. So that's kind of another aspect of that story. As far as the other, non non-forest, the animals that live in the habitat with humans being driven out by this kind of cascading process led by agriculture. So,
got it. So, the first serious colonization by people of European descent of our region occurred in the late 1800s. So not very long ago, and by 1930, almost all of the arable land in the Palouse was being farmed. So it's a very rapid transition. You know, give it 130 years, it took us to really drastically change the look of this land. And, you know, dams like Grand Coulee were completed in 1941. So that's that kind of marks the end of a habitat focus, changing into an agricultural focus. The indigenous people that lived in the Columbia Plateau are known to have used at least 135 plants for food. When I look at the forests around Spokane, having some experience in ethnobotany, which is the study of the use of plants by people, I realize that I'm standing in the kind of food forest that modern-day permaculture people are trying to rebuild. It was already there. If you look at, the woods around Minnehaha, the dominant tree there is the ponderosa pine, really familiar tree around here. It's not an excellent food, but it was definitely used as food in the past. The pine nuts were gathered and eaten as snacks. And the spring, when other foods were sometimes scarce, or in the winter even, the inner bark was used for food. If you look a little further down in the canopy, you'll find a kind of a shrub layer of service berries. And service berries are a phenomenal staple food that not many Americans know about or use, which is unusual, because just across the border in Canada, Saskatoons, that's the Canadian word for service berries, are famous for being used in pies. Everybody loves Saskatoon pies. But turn your eyes downward again, and you find arrowleaf balsam root, which is a perennial vegetable that was used by indigenous peoples. Don't ever try to eat a really big one. You want to dig the young ones and steam them. They can be kind of chewy. And a lot of other more delicious things in that same layer with the balsam root. There's lomatiums, biscuit roots of different kinds, and bitterroot, and sometimes camas, and yampa, all very tasty wild vegetables. I have some friends that call yampa dirt candy. It's really sweet. If you can imagine a sweet carrot anise kind of food, then you've got yampa. And then kind of wherever the soil is a little deeper, or even in between these forbs, you have grass, which feeds the large herbivores of the region, which people can eat. And, you know, whether that's deer or elk or, you know, the marmots nibble on the forbs and marmots are pretty tasty, actually.
By this time of year, they're big enough.
Yeah.
That's what I was told.
So that's the native food forest. That was our habitat. There's really no reason people couldn't rely very heavily on those native systems as they are. And what's even more optimistic is the idea of restoring or fostering even more optimal human habitats, which our region has tremendous potential for.
So that's a good segue into your project. And just if people are just joining us, you're listening to Praxis on KYRS, interviewing Kyle Chamberlain about the Human Habitat Project and general biodiversity, this region, history, etc. So we have this, like you were saying, so you're talking about fostering an even more rich human habitat than that. what is the primary difference between doing something like that and agriculture? Because that's a human altering of the land as well. So,
yeah, well, I think if you were going to pursue the perfect environment for yourself, you would want it to be a place where you could wander in naked and easily have all of your needs met without expending a lot of energy, without doing a whole lot of work or having to kiss up to anyone or any of that. So agriculture in our region clearly doesn't pass that test. If you wander naked into a wheat field, you're doomed. You're going to get sunburned, first of all, and you're going to die of exposure. There's no fuel for you to burn to stay warm. You can't eat wheat raw. It actually takes quite a bit of processing to render wheat edible. If you were to eat raw wheat berries, even if you could find some low-tech way of collecting them and cleaning them and threshing them, and you would get very sick.
Mm-hmm. You can't make it into any kind of weapon to hunt an animal with.
Well,
you might be able to make some kind of snare if you wove.
Good luck finding an animal in a wheat field. I drive through places like Lincoln County, and I don't see animals. I might see the occasional finch or a pigeon, maybe a mouse track or two. But for agriculture to work, animals, especially large herbivores, must be expelled. And you might think that, well, things like elk just don't live in the Columbia Basin anymore. Things like antelope don't live there. But elk are actively expelled. They're actively, violently expelled. There are what they call depredation hunts, where elk that do happen to cross the Columbia from wilder places are shot in the name of pest control. So you're out animal protein.
They end up in the suburbs here.
Yeah.
I mean, we get moose in the suburbs more often than you'd see them there. So
yeah, I was chased by a moose into someone's nice backyard. It chased me right over the fence. So there's that situation. Well, what does a good human habitat look like? I would say that it's a place where food is available that you can eat with minimal processing year-round, or as close to year-round as you can get in a cold place. That there is fuel for you to use. There's building materials for you to use. There's medicines for you to use should you need them. There's ways for you to make clothing if you need, without having to do a whole lot of work. I know if you happen to be in a canola field, a rapeseed field, you could potentially make some oil, but that would take a lot of technology. It would take a lot of work. It would be easier for you if you were living at a very simple level to shoot an animal and to render its fat. That would be a more efficient way for you to get your oil.
And it's better because that animal, before you killed it, was doing its thing and munching down. It was browsing and grazing and pooping and doing all the animal things that help everything else continue to grow.
Right? Sure.
I mean, that's...
The impact of animals is crucial to human habitat, actually. That's one thing I found when I was doing my homework, is that humans, our natural environment is savanna. We evolved in the pastures of the megafauna. It was our adaptation to savannas, to grassland and parkland environments that enabled us to expand across the world during the Ice Age, before agriculture was invented. And very quickly, without the presence of large herbivores in particular, our habitat begins to degrade. On this continent, The first people here are thought to have hunted megafauna almost exclusively. They utilize these tremendous animals that used to live here. And near Olympia, there's what's called the Manus mastodon site, where a mastodon was killed. At Lind Coulee, not too far from Moses Lake, there was a place where humans used to live hunting bison antiquus, which is the ancient bison. But when those animals were perhaps hunted to extinction, there are various theories about why they went extinct. Human lifestyles had to change, and we became responsible for maintaining the open savanna-like environments that we needed to survive. And indigenous people the world over did that by burning. And landscape burning is kind of the precursor to agriculture and the Neolithic Revolution, and we're beginning to modify our environment to look like one that's more fertile.
And were there drawbacks to that too, in the same way that there were with agriculture, or is burning a better solution generally?
Well, other than being a little risky and kind of one more thing that you have to do, burning proved to be pretty sustainable for indigenous peoples around the world. It's thought that people showed up here 14,000 years ago, maybe earlier, and they've lived sustainably for those 14,000 years. And that cannot really be said for agricultural civilizations, mm-hmm. Especially for places like the Lus Plateau in China, which is a region probably more like our Palouse wheat-growing region than anywhere else in the world, except that it's been farmed since China's Neolithic Revolution almost 10,000 years ago. And it's now ravines. They've lost so much soil. They've had so many of these dust storms and torrential rains like we've had on bare earth that humans are like living in caves excavated in these ravines. And there's actually some very optimistic work going on there in landscape restoration and damming up these gullies and terracing and trying to fix this land that's been damaged.
And it's, so I don't want to linger on this too long, but I think it's interesting whenever I, at least oftentimes, if I offer critique of industrial, and before that agricultural civilization, which I guess agriculture is what spawned civilization because it's the first time people live in one place and create cities, that are dependent on this big food source. People generally come at you with a series of pretty predictable, well, what about modern medicine? We can cure all these diseases and we went to the moon and this and that, and all of our great technology and communication. I don't know. For me, I guess it just seems like more of an accomplishment to not destroy the planet than to do all those things. Do you have any response to those comments that people will generally, the defense of civilization as the big great thing?
Sure. Well, we were talking earlier about, is there a problem? Did Indians in the Stone Age in North America wake up in the morning and think, I have this terrible problem. I need to become civilized. I need to start farming right away because I don't feel advanced. I don't feel like I'm reaching my full potential right now. I think that the problem is a story. It's a story that we tell in civilization because it's profitable for some people for there to be a problem. We have a lot of amazing achievements to be proud of, but so did Stone Age people. They had their problems, and we have our problems. You know, they didn't have the problem of the planet's environments becoming so destabilized that maybe they can't support the species anymore. So that's the historical perspective. Like, people in the past did not think that they were, you know, underprivileged. They probably were much like we were thinking that their age is the best age, and that everybody in the past labored to bring them about and mm-hmm. have this awesome existence that they have today.
And that's, I mean, what's interesting about it is that people who will really defend it will also not be happy doing what we're doing now. I mean, just if you look at it objectively and take every piece, it's kind of a raw deal that people get today. It's like work all the time so that someone else can grow all this wheat so that you have bread to eat and stuff. But it's really about work, 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 sell your labor, build something. You know, that's kind of the big produce something, build something bigger than yourself. And I don't think it's been satisfying for people overall.
No, of course you have to look at our evolutionary history. Human beings, 99.9% of our ancestors were hunter-gatherers, and that's the existence that we are physiologically and kind of designed in our minds for. And there was a paper written by Marshall Sollins in the 60s or 70s, I can't remember, but it was called The Original Affluent Society, and it rocked the anthropological world at the time, because he studied hunter-gatherers, and he found that they worked only 3 or 4 hours a day for their sustenance, which really surprised people. Because our story is that the Stone Age was you know, nasty, brutish, and short, and a lot of work, and that wasn't the case at all. And if you read the ethnography of the Sandpoil Nespelem Indians who lived on the Columbia River just north of us, they got most of their subsistence activities done before 10 a.m. They would get up before the sun got too hot and pick the berries or dig the roots that they needed, and have that all done so they could come back and loiter and gossip and hang out. You know, with the exception of very busy times like the fishing season, in which, you know, people were really trucking away to put away the dried salmon they need for the winter.
But then in the winter, you
chill
sit
out
around a fire and eat smoked fish all day.
Tell
right?
stories. Go yeah. to big winter dances. In fact, when fur trappers first came to our region and tried to employ local Indians trapping for them, they first had to teach them to make suitable winter clothing, because they didn't spend a terrible lot of time outside during the winter. They were hanging out in warm pit houses, and they occasionally went out on group hunts, but mostly they lived on stored food and mm-hmm. you know, hung out, made crafts and. Mm-hmm.
Why would you want to be outside in the winter around here? It just doesn't.
I lived in a pit house for a while. It was challenging in some ways, especially since I was also working full time for part of that. But it was nice to hibernate in a way.
Yeah. So that's kind of, and so I've heard. I don't know if you've heard this. I've read different accounts of East Coast, quote unquote, settlement and early colonial activity by Europeans, and that many Europeans who arrived deserted their original mission in favor of going to live with these people who were objectively having a much better time. There's stories of having to bring in more ships of people from Europe and paying people and bringing a higher percentage of indentured servants because the level of desertion in some of these colonies was so high to the tribes, who at that point were saying, yeah, sure, come share what we have. And they saw what they had and realized, wow, this is a lot better than a smoky city somewhere in Europe or toiling to dig for gold. I don't know if you've heard that or how substantiated that is, but...
I haven't read much about the history of the East Coast or indigenous people there. I'd like to talk more, if I could, about optimizing human habitat.
Yeah.
We were kind of going there earlier. As it turns out, the Inland Northwest is a phenomenal human habitat because of its precipitation regime, and that we get just enough rain for there to be forest in some places and for there to be steppe in others, you know, steppe or grasslands, shrublands. And these are the first places that humans colonized as they left Africa were these steppe environments because they were very productive in game. And I read a great theory in the Handbook of the North American Indian that talks about the Blue Mountains and their abundance of game. And the reason that the Blue Mountains are so abundant in game is because they have more forest edge. There is more blending of the forest and the steppe there than in other mountain ranges in the region. Because, you know, game can migrate in and out of the forest and back onto the steppe. So our region is very productive in that way. And then you also find, if you read about the different kinds of fruit and nut trees that you can grow, that most of the good ones come from Central Asia, which is an environment very much like our own. There are native apple forests in Kazakhstan. There are wild walnut groves in Kyrgyzstan, and jujubes, mirabelle plums, apricots are all things that come from Central Asia. And this makes sense because these plants that have co-evolved with large, hungry omnivores like ourselves are savanna, parkland, or steppe adapted. One way to see that is if you look at a modern pasture, you'll find that some of the only trees that can survive are hawthorns, which are in the rose family. They're related to apples and pears. And some of the ancestors of the apple are thorny in much the same way, as are a lot of the things that humans can eat, the fruit trees and thistles and things like that. And the other thing about the needs of human beings is that we're very picky eaters. Before we came out of the canopy, we were seeking out only the cream of the crop, only sugar-rich fruits. And when we came out of the forest, we were still looking for only very rich foods, whether that was animal protein or animal fat, or carbohydrates concentrated in root vegetables or fruit. And you need fertility in order to have nutrient-rich food. And fertility is best achieved in nature in that middle zone between forest and steppe. At over 30 inches of precipitation, soils become acidic. A lot of the nutrients leach out or become unavailable. And as you go drier, you get really alkali soils that are too kind of salty and basic to grow food. And what large herbivores do is expand savanna. So they'll go into the forest, they'll browse the trees. Mastodons were thought to even knock over conifer trees, the common conifer trees we know here, spruce trees, firs, pines, and browse them, much like elephants will knock over trees in the African savanna. So they're expanding savanna into what might be forested without their presence, pushing that grassland in there. They also expand grassland into the desert, into more arid regions, through their inner relationship with grass, which is described by Alan Savory, and that they're helping organic matter to cycle, whereas it might just dry out and oxidize in a desert environment. And the action of their hooves and their saliva and their urine and their dung on the soil can take what would be desert scrub and turn it into grassland by virtue of what they do. And that can be seen in Washington and parts of the Palouse that used to be grassland. Poor grazing practices, which you might call overgrazing, have degraded grassland into shrub steppe the other way. The reverse can happen. And that I call savanna theory, the idea that our ideal environment is partially treed and partially open. It's got shade. It's got fuel from trees. It's got nuts and fruits from trees. But it also has plenty of grass to feed our main meal, the herbivores. So you have fertility. And you also have the open conditions that many of the food plants that we eat need. They need plenty of sun. The plants that we use for food tend to be ecological underdogs. They need help to persist in the environment. For instance, an apple tree needs to disperse itself to clearings in the forest or to, you know, rare wet places in the desert. And that's why it creates the fruit, because it needs help. It needs help from animals. A lot of the food plants that we eat require the disturbance of the ground. They require nutrient concentration that can be provided by animals digging around or dunging on the soil. And so it's very heavily animal influenced landscapes that are the best habitat for us. The more animal use, the better, I think. And that's because we are adapted to live in an environment where the animals are actually the keystone species. They're in charge. It's not the trees. It's the animals that are kind of directing succession, which is something we don't see a lot of anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You have to go to places where there are bison left in North America to see that, or to places where there are things like camels or elephants.
And so how does that tie into your land that you have and what you've tried to do there? Are there animals there? Is there a way? I mean, there's not some of these animals that have already gone, you know, we're probably not going to bring back mastodons because that's millions of years of evolution. So where are we left now with rebuilding something like that?
I have a small piece of land. I'm not a rich man like Ted Turner. I can't buy a bison ranch. But I am trying to recreate that savanna-like environment using thinning and burning techniques like indigenous people here did. The forests in this region have been managed for timber, meaning that they want as many trees per acre as they can cram in. And the land that I've got was used for that. And so one of my key activities, that one of my big chores, is to open up this forest, which is dominated by these spindly kind of thin trees with just like a tuft of green at the top. They're really pathetic looking trees. A healthy tree should be at least two-thirds foliated, what they call the crown height of it, and there aren't very many looking like that now. So I've been using mechanical clearing, and I will be using fire to thin out the forest, which will make it better habitat for deer and for turkeys and possibly elk. And the other thing I'm doing is that I'm planting a long list of perennial food plants, and most of them are trees and shrubs. And on my website, which is called the Human Habitat Project, you can Google it, I've got that list of about 200 different tree and shrub species which will grow in this region that produce food. And they're a whole cornucopia. There's so many things you might never have thought of that you can grow from weird pistachio-like nuts like yellowhorn and the walnut relative, the heart nut, persimmon trees, honeyberry trees, which ripen very early in the season, honeyberry bushes, rather. Hickories. There's a hardy pecan. I haven't met anybody who knows for sure if pecans can actually ripen in this region, but the trees do grow rather well. I've seen one, and chestnuts and oaks for acorns, all kinds of oaks, and perennial vegetables like the Jerusalem artichoke and the Chinese yam and the groundnut. So I'm trying to create a place where I can be the laziest hunter-gatherer that you can imagine. And when I tell people I want to be a hunter-gatherer, they assume that I mean I want to go back to the Stone Age. But hunter-gatherer just means that instead of beating the land up, instead of like threatening it for your food, you kind of have a good relationship with it. You invite your good plant and animal friends to live with you, and you treat them well. You allow them to do what they do, allow them to exist, and have your needs met that way. Just how you have your social needs met by being nice to your friends. So that's what I'm doing. And you know, maybe I want to live in a modern style greenhouse. You know, maybe I would like to keep my laptop running, and I can still be a hunter-gatherer. It's not dependent on technology level, although you do find that when you live as a hunter-gatherer, a lot of the technologies that you thought were absolutely necessary are no longer. When you have plenty of fuel around and you can just grab a handful of it and throw it on the fire, maybe you decide you don't need a microwave. Maybe it's easier to cook on an open fire or build a simple rocket stove, which very efficiently burns.
And maybe it's more fun and won't give you cancer.
Sure.
I mean, while you're at it, you might as well add those benefits.
It's like, do I really need a Walgreens when I don't ever get sick enough to buy medicine? I think a lot of environmentalists have this kind of guilty, sacrificial approach to healing the planet. As people are bad, we need to make sacrifices and compromises, and we need to be uncomfortable to save the planet. And I prescribe to the idea that it can be fun. That let's plant a cornucopia of interesting fruit and nut trees and go for a walk and just chill out a little bit. The Neolithic was work. It's a ton of work to destroy the planet.
And it doesn't even make people feel good at the end of it. I mean, as far as needs being met, this is almost a design of like the worst possible way to try to do that globally, you know? There's a wide group of people at the bottom who work all the time and who don't really see a benefit of it other than possibly the convenience of going, to a grocery store instead of out and hunting. But
yeah, I think that's one of the elephants in the room in the story of civilization is that are our needs being met? That's the narrative. That's your argument for why modern times are better than the Stone Age. But if you look at it, do industrial people really even know what their needs are? It was discovered only recently that you need to have the right balance of omega-3 and omega-6 fatty acids in your diet, and without it, you're prone to all kinds of chronic illness. But if you go to a grocery store today, it's darn near impossible to obtain food that has the right balance of omega fatty acids. And that's because, just about everything in the grocery store is some kind of grain product, and B, all of our animals are fed with grain, whereas they used to eat grass, which contains the right balance and translates that way. So the healthy diet, the diet that we know our bodies require, was not only unknown until recently, but it's unavailable. And maybe if you can afford organic food, then you can buy the flaxseed fed chicken eggs,
hemp seed granola
and grass fed beef, but I know for me that isn't an option. I'm on the cheap junk diet until I can grow or gather my own.
And I think that and you could apply that to anything beyond diet, as far as not knowing what our needs are and then not being able to meet them. It's almost systematic across social, health, mental requirements of humans.
Ecological health.
Mm-hmm.
I have worked in the field of wilderness therapy, which is the idea that we can, fix a lot of human mental strife just by taking people outside. Mm-hmm. And the social needs are probably more misunderstood today than the physical ones. We're just now starting to understand the full impacts of what does the internet do to the mind? What does the isolation of a 9-to-5 job do to the mind? What does living in a city like this one, where at least half of the space is off limits to you, where you can't see into it? I look out the window here, and I'm surrounded by buildings where I would not be allowed to go. Which is very different than the prehistoric norm, where you can really go wherever you like. And look at whatever is going on. What does that do to a mind?
Yeah, I was hearing about and then reading a study that's been done in Sweden or one of those places where they're more prone to examining these things, that there's a direct relationship between people's internet browsing habits and their level of depression. And that it, as you increase the amount, the diversity and the and decrease the duration of your visits to wherever you are online, especially social media, if you're clicking through a bunch of different things and highly distracted, you're directly more likely to be depressed.
It's probably a positive feedback loop, like a vicious cycle. I know when I feel down, I tend to hit Facebook pretty hard myself. So yeah, there's a whole realm of psychological needs that human beings have that we don't know that the present situation is meeting. I lost my train of thought.
Sorry, I derailed. I derailed your train.
So you know, and even in when we do know what our needs are, can we meet them? Can we feed people in the developing world? Is the system working for them? Even if you do know that a healthy lifestyle is available to you, can you get there? You know, can you be healthy if you have a sedentary job? You know, can you be stimulated and have the play that any mammalian brain needs under the current kind of regime of how things work?
And that's something to find out, I guess, by experimentation. And that's what you're doing out there. And I really like this quote. I think this is your quote. Correct me if it belongs to someone else. But it's, our ignorance of the wild earth's capacity to meet our needs has cost us our freedom and dignity. The deliberate destruction of this capacity ensures our continual subservience. The story of civilization is one of denial, control, and manufactured scarcity. Truth, independence, and abundance are seditious values.
Mm.
Is that you?
That's me. And that reminds me of the train of thought that I lost. If I had to pinpoint the biggest psychological problem with civilization, with this industrial or agricultural existence, it's the insecurity, it's the lack of dependence, or the lack of independence, it's the domestication. We're living in a world where we've been deprived of a habitat, of a place where we can meet our own needs. In a place like Spokane, or even if you're lucky enough to live out in the country, say Lincoln County, you can't go outside and get what you need without paying for it, which basically means you're going to need to suck up to somebody. You're going to need to kind of play this sociological economy game that we've got going, just to have your needs met. And that's a problem not just of the fact that we've destroyed the savanna environments that were our habitat, but the fact that we've also destroyed our own knowledge of how to meet our needs. And in that way, we are domesticated. We are like the house dog that could not survive if it were not for his owner's kibbles and bits. And that insecurity that we have, I think that all civilized people feel this, manifests itself in all kinds of unhealthy ways.
Mm-hmm.
Manifests itself in codependent relationships. It manifests itself in power issues. And the previous program talked about rape. And I was talking to a friend recently who told me about her rape, and which led me to kind of look into the issue of rape. And I was talking to my therapist friend then, who made it clear to me, rape is not about sexual desire, it is about control. It comes from a desire to control things. And people, secure people, don't need to control things. The things that they need happen to them as a result of their having good relationships with other people. And I would extend that to the earth, to the living environment. And because our habitat is gone, our independence is gone, our security is gone. I think we need to look at our social habitat too. People evolved in egalitarian bands. There were small groups of people, usually less than 200, that related to their habitat to get their food, and they were nomadic frequently, and they lived in close proximity to one another. Usually separated by thin thatch walls. You pretty well know everything that's going on in a hunter-gatherer encampment with everyone. And I think, especially if you read about the history of the clash between Native Americans and Europeans here, is that we're dealing with people that were socially savvy. People who were clever with words, who could inspire, people who could kind of have power through spiritual means, through inspiring others, people who could get what they wanted from life with good social skills, versus what I think was the pioneer mentality of, I'm just going to work my tail off. It was...
And just possess everything. Not really know why, but yeah. Manifest destiny.
And then there were really insecure people that faced poverty from cities further east. People that were, maybe persecuted for religious reasons. That just wanted the right to survive. But had nothing to give that goal other than hard work, which Native people thought was kind of disturbing or hilarious.
Actually, we should just in the last couple minutes. Do you care if I read that other quote that you had?
Yeah. The Smohalla quote?
Mm-hmm. Smohalla is a Wanapum spiritual leader, 1851. My young men shall never work. Men who work cannot dream, and wisdom comes to us in dreams. You ask me to plow the ground. Shall I take a knife and tear my mother's breast? Then when I die, she will not take me to her bosom to rest. You ask me to dig for stone. Shall I dig under her skin for her bones? Then when I die, I cannot enter her body to be born again. You ask me to cut grass and make hay and sell it and be rich like white men. But how dare I cut off my mother's hair? That kind of sums it all up. I mean, as far as just the worldview aspect.
That would horrify my Christian grandparents for anyone to say, my young men shall never work. That says, here exists a culture that doesn't believe the way they make their living is work. And it says that, that our impression of the world is one in which you must work in order to survive, to earn your place, your right to exist, is a contrivance. It's something that we brought here that is not synonymous with human culture. I mean, I think in a social sense, a person needs to be able to kind of be a good member of their community. But the right to livelihood was something that was just kind of a birthright for people for most of our existence on this planet.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, thank you so much. And unfortunately, our hour's up, and we have to let the rest of the radio day unfold. Is there any last thing you want to add? And I'll post a link to Kyle's site, Human Habitat Project, in the podcast description for this show.
I would like to challenge anybody listening to do something this week that resolves your insecurity, whether that's learning an edible plant or whether that's learning a martial art, something that makes you a little less of a domesticate.
To undomesticate yourself. Thank you for listening, and thank you for being in here in the studio. This has been Praxis with Kyle Chamberlain on KYRS, Thin Air Community Radio. We'll be back next week for the first week of the On Air Fun Drive, and we hope to hear you then, to have you join and hear me then, if I can speak. So thanks so much for being on the show again, and I'm sure you'll be back.
Thanks for having me, Taylor.